Regardless of whatever else a person is feeling when they go to the doctor, hearing that they have cancer must feel like a punch to the gut. They'll feel many more things, both physical and emotional, in treating the cancer. But cancer patients can take an active role in treating their disease. Many types of cancer, many options in treatment. Our guest this hour works in the medical biz and helps people navigate that business in his book, Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. David Palma is an MD and a PhD. He's a radiation oncologist and a cancer researcher. His work focuses on cancers of the lung, head, and neck, as well as metastatic cancers. All of his proceeds from the book will be donated to cancer research. Dr. Palma, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's very good to have you. You acknowledge that cancer patients come to you better informed than ever, but you say there's still something missing. What is that?
Yeah, there is definitely something missing. Even though there's information about there everywhere on different types of cancer, there's really nothing out there about the importance of getting good quality cancer treatment. So if you're a patient, for example, with breast cancer, you can get a book about breast cancer or go online and learn about how it's treated in general, surgery, often radiation, sometimes chemo. But there's really nothing there to say, hey, this is how you can make sure you're getting good treatment. This is how you can double check what your doctors are recommending.
All right, so they have the basics on what the treatments might be, but not so much on how to actually interface with the doctors.
Exactly, and how to make sure that the treatments they're getting are the best. Just like you might read about a car online, but until you really go test drive the car, ask some questions to the car dealer, you might not know if it's a good car or not, if it's a lemon or if it's one of the best cars out there. So it really is probing to make sure you're getting good quality treatment.
You point out that a couple of reports on cancer care in the United States say many patients don't get appropriate care. What is lacking from their care?
Well, one thing that's lacking is that we don't do a good job of properly informing patients. And I can give you a good example of this, of a study that came out of Harvard a couple of years ago. They asked patients who were getting chemo, they said to them, what is the goal of your chemotherapy? Is the goal to cure your cancer or is the goal not to cure your cancer? And 3/4 of the respondents in that survey said, hey, you know, the goal of the chemo is for cure. But the interesting thing is that the people who they asked were only patients who were getting chemo that was not intended to cure the cancer, merely to slow it down. So what it tells us is that as doctors, we're not doing a good job of informing patients what our goals are. And so one thing I think that's very important that people can ask of their doctors is one very simple question to start the dialogue is, what are the goals of my treatment? Are we trying to cure this, meaning that the cancer will be gone if we're successful and I'll live out my normal life? Or is this just meant to slow things down, maybe giving some extra time, but not ultimately curing the cancer? And without that piece of information, it's really hard for people to make good decisions about what treatment they want, how to spend their time, how to arrange their finances, and that sort of thing. So a really simple thing like that can make a difference.
Well, with anything, I mean, treatment is going to vary given the patient's own medical history and conditions, but is it more acute with cancer that do you have to make sure that this is a very tailored program?
Yeah, so it's more than even just that. It even comes down to the basics of being given all the different options. And I can give you another example of this. For many men with prostate cancer, a lot of times the prostate cancer doesn't need to be treated aggressively. They will probably die of other causes before the prostate cancer gets them, because the prostate cancer can not cause problems for 10 or 20 years. So for many prostate cancer patients, there are 4 different options. There's surgery, there's radiation internally, there's radiation externally, and there's just observation. But when you look across the U.S., there are some pockets of the U.S. where the rates of men getting observed are very, very high. And there are some pockets across the U.S. where almost everybody's getting treated. And what this suggests is that people are not getting the same options across the board. They're not being given all the options. And we know that if you go to a surgeon, for example, first, they're more likely to recommend surgery, and a radiation doctor is more likely to recommend radiation. So what this book tells people to do is to go to the sources to see, here are the options, and the questions asked their doctors to make sure they're being given all of the different choices.
You give the example of a man treated for a kind of cancer that his hospital didn't specialize in. I mean, how do you find those kinds of things out?
Yeah, that's a very good thing, and that's a very, very good question that many people don't even think to ask. What people don't really realize is that not all cancer centers, not all hospitals are one-stop shopping. We can't expect that if you have a difficult cancer to treat, that the local hospital will be an expert in that. And what we see across cancer treatment is that cancer centers, cancer hospitals that are high-volume centers, they have better outcomes. And what I mean by that is that a high-volume center is where they treat your kind of cancer very, very commonly. I can give you another example of how this makes a big difference. You'll remember a few years ago, Patrick Swayze, he died of pancreatic cancer. So pancreatic cancer is one of the most difficult cancers to treat, but for some people, they can have surgery in an attempt at cure. So if you go for this surgery at a hospital where they do that surgery all the time, your chances of dying from the surgery are about 3 or 4%. So it's a modest risk, and it's a risk that we take with the goal of cure. But if you were to go have the same surgery at a hospital that doesn't do that surgery very frequently, the chance of dying from the surgery isn't 3 or 4%, it's actually 16%. So it's four times higher just from the choice of hospital. So another simple question that patients can ask is this a high-volume center for my type of cancer? Do you treat patients like me all the time?
So you're looking for the right treatment from the right team, but this raises the financial question, how many people's insurance will allow such choices?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. It's a very common question. And the interesting thing is that many U.S. insurance policies, when you're faced with a diagnosis of cancer, they require a second opinion as part of the treatment package before they go on and pay for the treatment. So in many cases, it's happening for some people already. But there are also ways to do that within your insurance. And even the chapter on second opinions talks about how to get free second opinions, ways that patients can go without any extra cost to them and get additional opinions. If it's very prohibitive, let's say, for example, you have no insurance, how can you do that without paying anything extra? And there are some tidbits in the book on how to get that.
All right, free second opinions. We like that, the title of that chapter for sure. David Palm is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is a radiation oncologist and a cancer researcher. His book is Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. And it advises you how to become a good patient and a good consumer at the same time. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone or by email. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about taking charge of cancer in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about cancer and that awful diagnosis and the shock it's going to provide for you. But once you're done being staggered by that, you can move ahead with the doctors and decide how you best can be treated. And that is what David Palma's book is all about. He is a radiation oncologist and a cancer researcher, MD and PhD. His book is called Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, David, it sounds like people ask you often to give advice on family and friends with cancer.
Yeah, we do get calls like that all the time. And it's part of being in this profession that people will get in touch with us. Even just recently, we had some long-lost relatives who I didn't even know, but they live just a couple hours from us, and they were in touch. And often what we try to do is just point them in the right direction and make sure that they're getting appropriate care.
And so it seems like this book was a natural thing to do for all the people who can't get a hold of you in person.
Well, you know, the true story behind the book, Jeff, is that a couple of years ago, my best friend was diagnosed. He was about 35. We went to high school together, and our families play together, our kids are good friends, our wives are good friends, and he was diagnosed a couple of years ago, and when he was diagnosed, we took a bunch of steps together, he and I, which included getting his medical records, making sure he understood them, and then making sure that he was getting all the options, he was getting good treatment. And at the end of the process, my friend said, you know, what people really need is they need a guidebook, they need a how-to manual, and that's where the book came from.
Well, and so you actually get into cancer basics here. You point out that our body's cells are usually very efficient. Do we know what goes wrong, or can you just tell us what it is that happens to them?
Yeah. And as complicated as cancer is, and there are thousands of different types of cancers, the fundamental thing is actually very simple in that our body is made up of trillions of cells, and these cells have instructions in them, just like a computer would have code. These cells have instructions, and the instructions are the DNA. But when the DNA gets damaged, we call it mutated, then the cell will act in a strange way, just like your computer would if the computer code was messed up. So anything that can cause a mutation, a change in the DNA of our cells, can cause cancer. So when you think about things that can cause mutations in our cells, you know, things that come to mind are Cigarette smoke is one of the most common. Different types of air pollutants can do it. UV light, sunlight, can cause that to happen to our skin, and then we get cancer. But one of the things that causes mutations that we really can't avoid is age. As we get older, we accumulate more and more of these changes in our cells. So cancer tends to be a disease of older populations. And as our population gets older, and as we are successful in fighting things like childhood infections, and as we have clean water in different countries, as we are better with dealing with heart disease, we see more and more people living longer, and then we see more and more people with cancer.
I guess the thing that surprised me most when you were talking about cells and what goes wrong is the idea that normally functioning cells have more or less a self-destruct feature, and that's one major thing that cancer cells lack.
Exactly. It's almost like Mission Impossible when you have, you know, a briefcase that's going to blow up if something goes wrong to, you know, hide all of the top-secret documents. Our cells have that process as well, and that they are made to self-destruct if there's a problem. And then when they do that, our little immune cells come and gobble them up, gobble up the pieces. But cancer cells find ways not to do that, to avoid the self-destruction, and then they can grow and grow. And the real problem of cancer is that the cells can travel through the body. And so they could go, for example, from being a breast cancer in the breast, they could travel through the blood to, let's say, the liver, where they could grow and cause problems, to the bones, to the lungs, sometimes to the brain. So this ability to spread, to set up little colonies elsewhere in the body, that is really the problem with cancer.
Well, those are two ways that you mentioned, growing in place and then moving in the blood. But there's also a third way, having to do with hormones. What does cancer do with hormones?
Yeah, so it is... scientifically, it's very interesting that the cancer can do this, but they can send out little hormones into the blood that have unwanted effects. So, as you know, hormones, they regulate our body very, very tightly, and when a cancer starts sending out hormones or things that are like hormones, it can cause big problems. So one of the things that some cancers send out into the blood is a little protein that can raise your calcium levels in your blood, and that can be a huge, huge problem because that can lead itself to death. And there are other things that can make you more tired. There are things that can make you lose weight. So it's something that people don't fully realize, but the cancer can affect you as a whole more than you might think.
David Palma, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, MD, PhD, radiation oncologist, cancer researcher. His book is Taking Charge of Cancer. We'll take calls in a few minutes. Once discovered, there are several steps in the process of nailing down exactly what's going on with the cancer. Would you describe the pathology report and why that's so important?
Yeah, the pathology report is really key. So what a pathology report is, it's actually just a report from a biopsy or from a cancer surgery where a patient has had a sample taken of their cancer. So let's say, for example, it's somebody with breast cancer and there's a lump found in the breast. The doctors would usually want to take a sample of that lump. So they'd put a needle in that, take a sample out to see if it's cancer. And that sample goes to a doctor called a pathologist. The pathologist looks under the microscope and looks to see what is there, and issues a report. And it might say, this is breast cancer, in some medical language, but actually usually pretty understandable. But the key thing is that almost everything follows from the pathology report. And by getting a copy of the pathology report, some errors can be avoided, and I'll give you some dramatic examples of those errors that have happened. But also it gives patients confidence in knowing exactly what kind of cancer they're dealing with. The stories that I'm talking about are some of the things in the news where you've seen doctors who've done some horrible things. Just a few months ago in the UK, there was a breast doctor who was convicted of operating on patients who didn't actually have cancer. And I believe it was last year, but in Michigan, there was a doctor sentenced to 45 years in jail for giving chemo to patients who didn't even have cancer. Horrible actions. And one way that we could prevent this in the future is by getting patients to ask, hey, can I see a copy of my pathology report? And with the tools in the book that helps patients to understand the report, you can see, hey, this is indeed a breast cancer, or this actually doesn't even show to be a cancer in the pathology report. But everything starts really from the pathology report.
So then the stages of cancer, 1 through 4, what do they generally indicate?
Yeah, so the stage tells people how big a cancer is and how far it has spread. Usually, for most cancers, it goes between 1 and 4, with 1 being a small cancer. So let's use the example of lung cancer, which is actually the number one cause of cancer death worldwide in men and women. So lung cancer, if it's a stage 1 lung cancer, it's usually small, like an inch in size, and it can usually be easily removed or treated, and the chance of cure is excellent. If it's a stage 4 cancer, that means that the cancer has spread elsewhere in the body, and almost always in that scenario, the cancer is incurable. And then stages 2 and 3 are in between, where the cancer is a bit bigger or it's spread to a few areas, maybe some lymph nodes, but is still curable. But many people know already to ask about their stage. They say to the doctor, "Hey, doctor, what's my stage?" And I'll say stage 3, and they'll write it down, and off they go to the next question. But what a lot of people don't realize is that if there's a mistake in assigning the stage, the whole treatment could be wrong. So if you're mistakenly assigned stage 4 because there's something on a scan the doctors are presuming is cancer, let's say somewhere else in the body, if you're mistakenly assigned to stage 4, you might be getting the wrong treatment. And we have seen examples of that occurring where doctors will assume that, let's say there's a spot showing somewhere else in the body, like in the bone. What you really need to do in many cases is take a sample of that to make sure that the cancer has really spread. But sometimes doctors don't do that. And so we have had situations where patients are classified as the wrong stage. So a very simple question is to say, what stage am I? When they say stage 3 or stage 4 or stage 1, you say, well, how do you know that that's my stage? And can you show me the imaging reports that tell that? And that's a very easy thing for a doctor to do. I do it all the time. And it can get the doctors to have a second look at things and also give you confidence that you're getting the right information.
So certain sets of protocols for how to treat certain kinds of cancers, but then that protocol will change depending on the stage.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, for example, for the stage 1 lung cancer, you would do surgery if the patient can tolerate it to take that out, and the chance of cure would be excellent. If you have stage 4 cancer, because it's not usually a curable situation, you wouldn't do anything that aggressive. So everything follows, you know, once you have the pathology report in the stage, really the only thing that then makes a decision about which treatment to have is the patient's condition and medical issues, and then the patient's own preferences. But if there's a problem with the pathology or a problem with the staging, it's very easy to go down the wrong path.
We are talking to Dr. David Palma, MD and PhD, about his book, Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. And it really is a how-to guide for how to talk to your doctors, the information to request, getting a hold of your own medical records, all sorts of things like that. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Maybe you have a story about cancer treatment you can share with us. We'd like to hear those, or a question for kinds of treatments. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the exchange.
Good morning. Dr. Palma, what about alternatives to traditional treatments with chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery? Are there other interventions that seem to be working? I keep hearing about miracle cures with cannabinoids, CBD oil, things along those lines. My own physician said he had seen miraculous results, but everything I'm seeing has to do with anecdotal evidence as opposed to any kind of studies. Can you address that?
All right. Thanks for that, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. And that's an excellent question. So the way that we look at it from our perspective is that once something has been shown to be effective, then we start to use it as part of standard medical practice. And if it's shown to be not effective, we don't use it. But you're right. We do get a lot of questions about alternative medicines. And I think most doctors nowadays are open-minded about these kinds of things. And we try to embrace things. We try to study them as much as possible. But it can be very hard from our perspective because you can go online and you can Google so many different things to find web pages that say that they are curing cancer, including the cannabinoids and CBD oil, but also, you know, baking soda, IV vitamin C, apricot seeds, all kinds of stuff. And the problem with these anecdotes is you don't really know how true they are. You don't really know if the patient is telling the truth or if they also had some anti-cancer treatment. The patients that I've seen who've gone on the cannabis-type products, they sometimes have some pain relief, sometimes they have some improvement in their appetite, improvement in their nausea particularly, but never have I seen an example where it has actually fought the cancer itself. So what I say to patients when they are evaluating alternative treatments, which I think is, Paul, very reasonable to evaluate, is to be aware of two things. So one is when they're promising something that sounds enormous, like they're saying that you're going to be cured. Because even when I have a patient, let's say I have a patient whose chance of cure is really high, like 95%. I don't say to them, this is going to cure you, this cures everybody, because that's not true. We couch it with some uncertainty. So if you're getting a promise, it sounds like they're promising you the world, just like everything else in life. If it's too good to be true, it probably is not true. But the other thing to be a little bit worried about is the finances. And so if something doesn't cost a lot of money and you want to try it, just discuss it with your doctors, and in many cases it'll be reasonable. But we have a lot of unreasonable charges for things, tens of thousands of dollars. I've had some patients, for example, who have tried IV vitamin C. And so if you go online, it seems that IV vitamin C cures cancer if you look at some websites. But when they've done studies of high-dose vitamin C in cancer patients, it actually hasn't been shown to have any effect on the cancer at all. Some studies suggest maybe some better quality of life in terms of feeling better, but nothing has shown that it fights cancer. And so the problem is that patients are often paying a few hundred dollars for each injection, and that's happening a couple times a week. So you can easily throw thousands down the drain. So those are the two things I tell people to consider is what are they promising and how much does it cost? But please, I encourage people who are considering alternative treatments, have a chat with your doctor, because most doctors nowadays are very open to those kinds of discussions.
Another question here from John in Ashland via email. He says, as a radiologist, you're aware that a wide variety of substances, ranging from foods to pharmaceuticals, have been shown in peer-reviewed studies to be radiosensitizers. Why do I rarely hear oncologists talk about low-risk, evidence-based strategies, including using radiosensitizers as a way to improve treatment outcomes? That again from John in Ashland.
I think you have the most well-informed questioners that I've ever come across. So John and Ashland should come work for us. So we do use some radio sensitizers. So this is a perfect concept in that if you can give a drug that just targets only the cancer, and then you can give a bit less radiation, but that drug might make the cancer more sensitive to radiation. So you can give less radiation, but this drug makes the radiation even more potent. And we do use some, but the problem until now is that most of the radio sensitizers have been fairly toxic in themselves. And one example of that is one of the best radio sensitizers is a type of chemo. But we're searching for them, and there's actually a really interesting thing that's happening now with a new type of drug called immunotherapy. So immunotherapy has just come out, and John's probably aware of this. So immunotherapy is a new treatment approach, new class of drugs that have just come out in the past couple of years, where instead of using drugs to attack the cancer, like chemotherapy, what immunotherapy does is it takes the brakes off the immune system, and then the immune system goes and attacks the cancer. And immunotherapy has been, for some cancers, it's been completely game-changing for things like melanoma, which is a skin cancer, for things like lung cancer, for bladder cancer, head and neck cancer. Immunotherapy has had a big impact. And it, in some cases, it might work even better when given with the radiation, because the radiation alerts the immune system a little bit better about the cancer. So kind of the same thing that John is asking about. But John is right, and I think that's a research avenue that will be even more important in the coming months.
David Palma, again, our guest. His book is Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. So this takes us to the first consultation after the diagnosis. What and who to bring to that first consultation?
So we know that at the first consultation, it's hard to remember everything. It's easy to get overwhelmed. Sometimes doctors aren't using straightforward terms. Sometimes we use too much medical jargon. And there's so much important information, you don't want to miss it. And so there are a couple of good strategies. One very easy strategy that many people do already is to make sure they bring a sidekick with them, somebody who can take notes, somebody who can help formulate questions in advance. And if you have someone in the family with a medical background or a healthcare background, like an RN or even someone like a physio or somebody who works in the hospital in any capacity or works with a physician in any capacity, that can be very, very helpful. But technology has changed, and what many people do now is even better, and they audio record the conversation with their doctor. So what they do, you know, it used to be that people would bring in tape recorders, but I haven't seen a tape recorder brought in about 10 years.
Neither have we.
Just as your studio has changed, right, Jeff?
Right.
So the people use their smartphone now, and they just ask your doctor, say, hey, is it okay if I can record this conversation? Because that way when I get home, I can listen to it again. And my family members who aren't here can also listen to it again. And it gives people a better insight into what's going on. And that's a very easy step that people can take. And in my experience, most doctors are quite happy with that. There's even a doctor near where I work who offers that as a standard. When patients come in, he says, hey, you know, we have audio equipment here. Do you want to record it? And then you can download it through a secure website. So it really does help people to have a good understanding of what's going on.
So when we talk about going through medical history, how important is that history? And even if you think something is insignificant, I mean, how small into the details should you go when discussing things in that consultation with the doctor?
Yeah, that's hard to make a blanket statement about how much information should you know. But what I say to patients is make a list of all your important medical conditions. And those include things like surgeries, things like diabetes, high blood pressure. But extremely relevant is whether you've had any cancer treatment in the past. And if you have, getting as much information about that before you go. Because if you're having treatment and you've had a previous treatment for cancer, the previous treatment can affect your doctor's choices. For example, if you've had part of your lung removed, then it can make it difficult to remove more of your lung. If you've had previous radiation, that also can impact on what's going on. But the other thing that people should take stock of is not only just their medical past, but also their preferences and thoughts about how aggressive they want to be. Some people, they would like to have every possible treatment with the goal of cure, and that's actually a very common approach. Whereas other patients, they're more focused on quality of life and maintaining that quality as long as possible. And a lot of that depends on whether the goal is for cure or for not. So what I say to patients is try to take some stock about your own preferences so that when the time comes, when the doctor is going to give you some options, you can discuss those with your doctor as well.
Back to talk more about taking charge of cancer with Dr. David Palma in a minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. David Palma, as MD and PhD. He's a radiation oncologist and cancer researcher. He's written a book called Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. It really is a how-to book for how to approach treatment for cancer. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or stories to share about your own treatment in the past, perhaps. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you certainly want people to come in armed with some details, participate in the process as much as possible, but also make sure that they're holding on to some things, including medical reports. What do you recommend patients do with those, David?
Well, getting the medical reports is a good way to double-check that everything is being done and that you really understand what's going on. So what the book talks about, we talked earlier about the pathology report and the imaging report, and the book gives you techniques to go through those to understand what's going on. And what that allows you to do, once you know your stage, for example, like we talked about, you can go to reputable websites, and I give some in the book, and see what the standard treatment recommendations are for your kind of cancer. So we talked about the situation with prostate cancer where there are four different options, and one of them includes observation, but across the U.S., people are getting totally different treatments, suggesting that not everyone's getting all the options. But there are reputable websites where you can go to, and you can look based on your type of cancer and the stage, and it'll tell you what the standard recommended options are. These are called treatment guidelines, and what they do is they summarize all the treatment options for physicians who are too busy to keep up with all the latest research. And by going to, let's say, the U.S. National Treatment Guidelines, you can look to see that you're being given all of the options in your scenario.
I know you don't want to speak too ill of other doctors, but if you present treatment guidelines to your doctor and that person appears to know nothing about what you're talking about, is that perhaps a doctor you might want to avoid?
It may be, Jeff. But the thing to realize is that the treatment guideline is a starting point. So let's say, for example, that you have a patient with a lung cancer, and the treatment guideline suggests that lung cancer should be removed as surgery as the first choice. And when you look at the treatment guidelines as a patient, it has other options on there. But maybe in your scenario, for example, surgery is not a good idea for some of your other medical reasons, or your doctor's, there's something about the tumor where they're worried about taking it out. And doctors in many cases will have to deviate from the guidelines. The guidelines aren't sort of cookie-cutter medicine, but they're a starting point for a conversation. So I think if your doctor's never heard of the guidelines, that's definitely a bad sign, because pretty much every doctor will have heard of these guidelines. But what a doctor would be able to do is say, okay, you know, here are the guidelines. In your scenario, surgery is recommended, but here are the reasons why that's not what we're recommending, and we think this is a better option for you. And that's totally fine. What I would be worried about is if they said, oh, you know, I don't believe in guidelines, or, you know, something dismissive like that. But what they should be able to do is put your scenario into the context of the guidelines and then say why they're not treating you in that regard.
Treatment aside, when it comes to diagnosis alone, are there some kinds of cancer that are particularly tricky to diagnose correctly in general and would require more tests?
Yeah, you know, it's usually easier to detect a cancer that gives you a symptom, and hopefully early on. So if you think, for example, of the case of bladder cancer, that's often detected fairly early because a bladder cancer will bleed a little bit, and then you'll get blood in your urine, and then most people at that point hopefully will go to the doctor. You can just put a little camera in, and the diagnosis is made. That's usually fairly easy because it's a symptom that people will normally act upon. The difficulty we have with other kinds of cancers is that they don't give you symptoms right away. And a good example of this is lung cancer. You could have a fairly large lump growing in your lung that's a cancer and not causing you any problems at all. And so we know that about 1 in 3 or even a little more than 1 in 3 patients with a lung cancer, it's only detected after it's spread to other parts of the body. So that's why for lung cancer now we're moving into screening programs using low-dose CAT scans, which we call CT scans. We're moving into screening and that sort of thing. So really some cancers are very easy to detect. Some are not so easy.
Well, once the detection's gone on and everybody's sure about what the type of cancer is and the stage, now even within the guidelines for what you do with type of cancer X and stage whatever, how much does a person's age and otherwise overall health dictate the terms of treatment as well?
Yeah, it can play a big role. It can play a big role. So a treatment that we would give to somebody who is in their 50s and 60s might not be appropriate for somebody who's in their 70s and 80s. And that difference actually is most pronounced in places where they don't do the treatment a lot. And I'll just give you an explanation of that. So as you get to be older in your 70s and 80s, you don't tolerate invasive treatments quite as well. So surgery, you have more of a chance of complications. Radiation, you have more chance of complications. And same with chemotherapy. And in some cases, as you get into your 70s and 80s, the complication risk is actually higher than the chance of actually benefiting. So a lot of scenarios, we stop doing chemo for people in their 70s and 80s because the benefits just aren't there. But a lot of times, let's say you're in your 80s and you need a surgery, or a risky surgery, and that's really the best option for you. Those are the scenarios where going to a high-volume center, like I talked about earlier, has really been shown to make a big difference. When people are at especially high risk of a complication, it's important to consider going to a higher-volume location.
All right, so a hospital that really knows that type of cancer and operates on it a lot.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, when you were talking about the treatment guidelines, it does make me wonder, because the medical news to the general public changes fast. It seems like every week there's a new report that often refutes one that came out about 2 weeks or a month ago. And I wonder how often that situation is duplicated in the medical realm as well, that you get new guidelines revising the old ones, or wait, we thought this was so, but now it's not.
Yeah, we really do have a problem with media and research and the way that we as scientists can present things in the media sometimes, where things are touted as breakthroughs when they're really not, or a relationship is said, you know, vitamin E is good for you, is not good for you, vitamin D, the same thing. We have these flip-flops. The problem with a lot of that research is it's not really, really robust. And in cancer, when we really want to make good decisions, we rely on very special studies that are called randomized studies. And I talk about this in the book to give people a perspective, but really the only way to compare a new treatment versus an old treatment is to have people join the study, and half of them get the new treatment, half of them get the old treatment. But who gets which is dependent on just a flip of the coin by a computer. And the reason why we do it that way is that way you get two, on average, you get two very equal groups. The group that got the treatment that's new should be very, very comparable to the group that got the older treatment. If you pick who goes into which group, or I pick who goes into which group, it's very easy to be biased. So these guidelines really rely on the highest quality of data. So they won't flip-flop over something very small, but they will change if there is a big study that gives new information. And they're updated on an annual basis. So you can go, and even the 2018 guidelines are already out for all different types of cancer. The 2017 ones are still there. But the process of change is slow. You know, from year to year, there's not a huge change. Over a couple years, there often is. And it really depends on what the new things are. So things like immunotherapy that I told you about, this new immune-stimulating treatment, that's now in the guidelines for a few different types of cancer where it is shown to make a big difference.
And not in the 2017 guidelines?
Well, they would have been, but they probably wouldn't have been in the 20. They would not have been in the 2013 or 2014 guidelines. I'd have to check exactly the year that it came out. So it does change over a couple of years.
As you point out, David, doctors do occasionally disagree on treatments. What kinds of things, and how do we as patients deal with those?
Yeah, so doctors can agree for good reasons and for bad reasons. So the good reasons to disagree is just an honest difference in opinion. So one person might feel like surgery is the best option, and another person might feel like radiation is the best option. And in that scenario, the best thing to do is to provide both opinions to the patient. And I'm going to give patients a tip in just a second on how to sort of get all those opinions in one. But what we see in medicine, unfortunately, is other biases coming in. And we know, as I said earlier, that surgeons tend to recommend surgery. Radiation doctors tend to recommend radiation. There can be influences around pharma. There can be influences around how physicians are paid when doctors are making recommendations. A good way to get around this is very simple. At many different cancer institutions, they have these meetings called tumor boards. And these tumor boards are team huddles where doctors of all different types will get together to discuss patient cases. So there will be a tumor board for breast cancer and a tumor board for lung cancer and a tumor board for prostate cancer. And at that tumor board, a patient's case will be discussed. They'll go through the symptoms that led to the diagnosis. They'll have another look at the scans. They'll have another look at the pathology report. And then the whole group in the room, which will be surgeons, radiation doctors, everybody, will give an opinion as to a recommendation, or they might give several different recommendations. And at many centers, this is no additional cost, no additional time for the patient. So a very simple thing people can do is say, hey, can you discuss my case at a tumor board? And in many situations, doctors will be able to do that.
Oh, okay. So is that part of the process you talked about in the book as well of getting free second opinions?
Absolutely, yeah. That is one of them. And so some smaller places might not have a tumor board, but there are now some U.S. groups that are running virtual tumor boards where people can log in and get discussions as a physician. So the bigger centers definitely will have them. Some of the standalone centers may not, but there may be ways around that.
All right, so what, beyond the stuff that you can get for free potentially, how I want to ask again, as you go along through the process of determining what kinds of treatments, how much insurance can occasionally hamstring this process?
Yeah, so it really depends on the type of insurance and what the treatment is going to be. So most insurance, there are in-network providers where you could easily go to another location to get a second opinion. The difficulty really with insurance that we see is when some drugs are not covered or people are getting beyond the lifetime coverage. And we as physicians realize that this is an enormous problem. And it makes us very upset. You know, many of these new drugs like immunotherapy that I told you about, they're wonderful. But the problem is that the pharmaceutical companies are pricing them at the very limit of what they think people will pay. So you might hear people say, especially pharmaceutical companies, well, that reflects the cost of development. You know, these drugs cost a lot of money to develop. But we've seen that regardless of the cost of development, whether it's cheap to develop or not, new drugs coming out, they just price them at around $10,000 a month. That's just the new thing, which is enormous. And it, for many physicians, it makes our blood boil because we feel that, well, it's not a free market. It's not a free market when one party has the drug and the other party needs the drug to stay alive. So that is really the difficulty around insurance, is just these spiraling costs of drugs, which I feel can really only be addressed at the governmental level. It really needs an intervention by government to say, listen, we're being held hostage from these drugs, whether it's old drugs that the prices are going up or the new drugs where they're pricing them at $10,000 a month. Because as a patient, it's very hard to as one person really change that. As a physician, it's also very hard to change that. But it really needs sort of a groundswell of outcry around the way that pharmaceutical companies are charging for their drugs.
Now, the goal of treatment will differ depending on, obviously, a lot of things having to do with type of cancer, age of patient, et cetera. And so they get you into the section of the book about curative versus palliative care, which is really a land of hard truths. How do you help people understand that they may feel comfortable, but their time is limited?
Yeah, it's never an easy discussion, to be honest, Jeff. It is always something that we handle very carefully. But what we try to do is give people the tools to make the most of the time that they have. And what that might involve, in some cases, people would like treatment that will extend their life, because sometimes chemotherapy, even if it can't cure people, can extend life by many, many years. We see that, for example, with colon cancer is one great example where sometimes people are living 4 or 5 years with a colon cancer that, without chemo, would only give them about 6 months. But it's a balance of how much of an effect the drugs have on their life versus the benefit of how long they get. So what we really try to do in this scenario are two main things. One is to get a good idea of the patient's wishes. What do you want? How aggressive do you want to be? What do you want to try that might provide you with an additional time? But the other thing is to make sure that they have additional supports in place. So what does this individual person need? Do they need someone to come to their home, for example? Do they need social work or spiritual care? Do they need financial help or at least someone to help them sort through their finances? And making sure that they have the resources to access what they need. The final thing I always ask people to think about is to think about entering a clinical trial. And a clinical trial is where new promising drugs are being tested before they eventually end up shown to be helpful, although sometimes they're not shown to be helpful. But if you're lucky, if you enter a clinical trial, you might get a drug that is helpful but is not otherwise available because they're still testing it. And that's what we saw with immunotherapy. A couple of years ago, people would be offered, hey, do you want to go on this trial to try the immunotherapy? At the time, we weren't totally sure how well it worked. Once those patients got it, that really showed us that it was helpful.
There's a real wealth of information in the book to let you know how you can approach. And yes, your eyes might glaze over at times, but David Palm is good at talking you out of that. The book is called Taking Charge of Cancer, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Treatment. David Palm, a radiation oncologist and cancer researcher, and our guest on The Exchange today. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
All the best, Jeff. Thank you.
All right, take care.